Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Guy Hasselman and Ira Harris. Guy is a macro strategist and former head of rate strategy at Scotia Capital. Ira is a hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and back on the board today. Welcome, Guy and Ira.
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. It's great to be with you.
Great. I thought we'd begin a discussion with what's a topic that's a lot on everybody's mind is U.S. yield curve inversion. And the deepening of that, why is this happening? What are the drivers? And importantly, do you see that yield curve changing perhaps and steepening anytime soon and under what conditions? Guy?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversations now that the yield curve inversion is a function of the warning sign to a recession. And historically, there's some truth to that when it's persistent and long lasting. But what's not often discussed right now is the fact that the yield curve is being monumentally manipulated by global central banks. So it's hard to tell how much of it is a warning sign. And I think there is some predictive power there. Germany's already in a recession. Korea, Japan, there's a lot of pockets of serious economic weakness. But global central banks are hoarding $25 trillion worth of assets on their balance sheet. And so that creates all kinds of unintended consequences. And it certainly distorts the shape of the yield curve. It distorts absolute yield levels, and then the sellers of those bonds have to go into other types of securities to replace the government bonds that they're selling to central banks. So there's a big distortion type of effect on that. But certainly an inverted yield curve is not good for the banking system. And I'll stop there.
Ira, your thoughts?
I agree wholeheartedly. And the most important part is, of course, is the manipulation and therefore the destruction of the signaling mechanism of the bond markets. You know, they've broken it. And therefore, as you know, to paraphrase Colin Powell to President Bush upon invading Iraq, if you break it, you own it. You know, it's a pottery barn. And they've broken it, so they own it, and yet they don't really want to own what they've done to it, and they look for other reasons. And now you have all these experts who are, and I use that term very loosely, who are all talking about the impact of yield curves. But if you talk about yield curves without context, it's a meaningless discussion because I don't know how old Guy is, but having lived through the Volcker and actually been a trader and working in the business during that time, when Volcker forced an inversion of the yield curve, well, that was not like none other. And there was a purpose to that one. This one, I can't, the purpose is because the central banks have continued down a path that is just ridiculous. They've gone from providing liquidity and preventing a liquidation of the financial system, which was, I would agree that it was a necessary event, into being the all-encompassing knowers and thus manipulators of the financial system. And it has caused this, and I'll stop there too.
Well, I'll actually add on that, if I can pile on to this monetary lunacy. Central banks are really falsifying reality, and this is really central bank strategy drift. where they've gotten out of the business of central banking and into the business of trying to centrally plan. And like you said, when you break a country, you own it. Well, they're wrecking everything. And who are these unelected, unaccountable officials who are a bunch of PhDs who really don't know how the markets work? They're more of a textbook to assume that what they know is better than price discovery. Price discovery can happen through supply and demand and hundreds of millions of people trading stocks and bonds and other things, even determining the price of money and credit. And they're basically trying to centrally control and think that they know better than the marketplace. And the unintended consequences, I mean, they're basing it on some Phillips curve that they hide behind and their dual mandate. I mean, if it's really a dual mandate, give me a break. I mean, there was no economic case whatsoever for the recent rate cut. It just shows you how they've become politicized, or they're really worrying about the equity market or the White House or something else. But it certainly wasn't within the realm of why the Fed was created in 1913, nor an economic justification for that rate cut.
And you also see other unintended consequences as well, right, Guy, in terms of widening inequality, asset bubbles, fueling indebtedness. Can you elaborate?
And it's even worse than that. You're right. Let's think about what they're doing. So they push the price of money, interest rates, down to zero. It creates the fact that money is less than free now. It's almost that you're getting paid to be a debtor. That is completely unsustainable, and that is really dangerous. But the corporations, and so there's a moral hazard issue. You're incentivized to be a debtor. You're incentivized to speculate, but who's getting punished are savers and pension funds and those that are trying to be prudent. And that type of moral hazard incentive is extremely dangerous. Corporation, you know, we had a debt bubble, right? The 08 crisis was really a crisis of debt from interest rates that were too low for too long. And Fed policy since has lowered interest rates so that sovereign debt levels as a percent of GDP are far higher. The corporate bond market is about 2.5 to 3 times larger than it was in 2007. And it was all to try to support some type of real capital spending. But corporations didn't use the money for that because there's no visibility. And so they used the money to actually give the illusion of prosperity to buy back their shares, which is, or increase their dividends. And now it's made worse by the President Trump, who has really tied his reelection and his presidency to the level of the stock market. So he is really incentivized to try to keep it going. And what have we done in the 126th month of this real negative rates, where GDP has been, you know, maybe slower than it should have been at 1.5 to 3, but the fiscal levers kind of opened up on top of it. It's sort of like what happened when, you know, things are going well, you should save for a rainy day. Instead, it was pedal to the metal. And 2020, we're going to have debt that's going to be growing even quicker because the fiscal deficit is going to be 4.5%. And so there's a lot of unintended consequences of the Fed's determination to try to create 2% inflation. And one more thing, let me just add that 2% inflation, I do not know why that would be a good target. I mean, Greenspan defined stable prices as, quote, that state in which expected changes in the general price level do not effectively alter business and household decisions. Okay, so why do we need inflation to go up? It means that the purchasing power of your hard-earned money will be cut in half in 36 years. I'm not so sure why that's a really good objective. And again, it all comes back to this moral hazard.
Ira, do you see similar unintended consequences?
And it is, it's the 2% target, which emanated from Don Brash and as the head of the Bank of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, which New Zealand was in a far different situation, of course, as a fairly homogeneous country of what I'm not sure how small the population. I can't say how big it is, but how small the population is. It's ridiculous. And I think Greenspan's definition, as Guy says, it was absolutely, that was an operative definition. The 2% is really a joke. The Phillips curve, and I'm sorry, I've argued this for 40 years. The Phillips curve is dead in a globalized system where money flows freely because money is allowed to chase low wages. And as long as you have that without any type of capital controls, capital wins. And capital will always be in search. And then, of course, you add in the advance in transportation, you crush the unions. So the Phillips curve, which had relevance during the time of private sector unions, I'm not talking about public sectors, that's a whole different part of the discussion, but private sector unions have been decimated. And I was on the other side of that because I did a lot of organization work back in the 70s in pushing for private sector unions, but those have been absolutely destroyed. And as I, you know, when I'm out with Rick Santelli, I've made the quip several times. In fact, one time I'm actually going to wear a Nehru jacket, because when Bernanke would talk Nehru, the non-accelerated inflation rate of employment, I would talk Nehru, meaning another billion Indians entering the global labor market, driving wages ever lower. So tell me where the Phillips curve could possibly have any. But it's all, the 2% inflation is all about the fact that we live in a debt, the United States, especially in a debt-based economy. And so you want inflation because nothing eases debt loads like inflation. So that's what we resolved on. And when they compare it to Japan, it's such a flawed argument to me, because when Japan had 50 basis, don't forget they weren't zero, they were probably 30, 40, 50 basis point 10-year yields. They had deflation or disinflation of 1.5%. So if I was a Japanese bondholder, I was still getting a real return of anywhere between 1% and 2% on my money. And lo and behold, 97% of the Japanese bond market at the time was held by domestic bondholders between the pension funds and everybody else. So those who talk about Japan, I'm looking at a headline right now, Japanification of the economy, it's so badly flawed. And I think Guy is 100%. And now they've gone down this path. And I'm going to end with this, because the way that this is going to end, and it has to end, and I say this all the time, if you're an investor, forget if you're a trader. A trader, I understand, you buy a negative yield bond because you hope to be able to sell it back to the ECB or somebody else who has to buy it. But if you buy anything in the U.S. more than 2 years out, I think you need your head examined, because if the central bank is successful doing what it's doing, you're a major loser. And if they're not, you've got more things to worry about. And if you're involved in this, you cannot own this stuff. It makes zero sense. The curve, if interest rates were allowed to work, the curve would be steepening like it did. If we remember what happened after QE1, the curve really steepened out because everybody said, oh, look what they're doing. They're pumping all this liquidity in. And then QE2 also, the curve steepened out. But then, of course, it wasn't allowed to. They slayed the quote-unquote bond vigilantes, and the curve started to flatten. But this is all by the hand of the central banks, all by the hand of the central banks. And it's a global phenomenon.
Yeah, I don't know how any fiduciary can justify saying that they're maximizing return per unit of risk. It's lunacy. And the 1970s, the Phillips curve should have been debunked in the 1970s when we had stagflation. And that's the one risk right now that I think that people, and I'll give a little warning about what I'm concerned about, is that people think, you know, well, we're headed into a recession and deflation will fall that much faster. But if we fall into a recession because of this currency wars that seem to have propped up and this race to bottom and interest rates to try to devalue a currency, if the cause of the recession is all of those countries trying to turn inward to be better on a relative basis, that I would define that as anti-globalization. Right? Technology and globalization over the last 30 years has really made it so we could trade with each other. You find your lowest cost producer. Everybody wins. It's really done more to lift the human condition than anything in modern history. I mean, it's been truly exceptional. But if you have the anti-globalization trade, which is currency wars, tariffs, protectionism, and then all of a sudden some of those really optimized supply chains start to become disrupted, and companies have to go to their second or their third producer of parts and goods and things like that. Now, all of a sudden, you are talking about this slower growth, slower supply lines, but higher prices. And you could end up in a situation that's a little bit like the 1970s. That would really put central banks into a double pickle. And certainly all these investors that have been chasing higher and higher asset prices. I mean, Ira, you laid it out pretty well, that the lunacy of it is that some of the people who are buying it are counting on a greater fool to be sell their bond that has no value at a very high price. They're counting on the ability to sell it at an even higher price. And that's irresponsible as a portfolio manager or a fiduciary to be thinking along those lines. But I do worry about this anti-globalization impetus right now that could lead to significantly lower growth and a little bit higher inflation. I'm not saying that's my baseline, but I'm saying that is an extraordinary risk to the way portfolios, you know, there's just too much dependence on central banks. That central bank put is alive and well, but you're counting on bigger and bigger bubbles, and the fact that these central banks can be successful in order to create bigger and bigger bubbles. And I think that's a pretty low probability.
It's really, you know, a phenomenal point, because, first of all, I'm glad you bring up the currency wars, because there's, I mean, everything we're talking about today, and then we get this piece from Bill Dudley, the New York Fed president, who wrote this piece that was so scathing in its substance that the Federal Reserve had to respond to it with a very open statement that they were not looking to politicize monetary policy. But when I read the Dudley piece, and then I reread it and read some of the, you know, what people were talking about, Bill Dudley makes a gigantic mistake, because, you know, Richard, you and I have talked about this many times, that Donald Trump has trapped the Fed, because as soon as Jay Powell did his pivot back in, and I know, Guy, from reading some of your stuff, you know, some of your writings, I won't call it stuff because that's a demean it, and I'm not demeaning it whatsoever. It's quite good. But when he did his pivot, he fell into Donald Trump's trap, because as long as Donald Trump could rile the markets at any given time with tariffs, the Fed was forced to respond, or at least not raise rates. So what Stanley Druckenmiller so beautifully talked about in December, which is, and I agreed with it well before that, but the double barrel approach, which was quantitative tightening coupled with raising interest rates, was a disaster waiting to happen. And he was proved very prescient. But the fact that Powell pivoted so well, Trump knew that he had him trapped, and you could see it over and over again. And we just saw it on Thursday, Friday, when Powell gives the speech, and then Trump the Chinese beat Trump to the punch on it, but then Trump, of course, followed through with it in even a more caustic manner. Of course, Dudley says today that the Fed shouldn't do anything. Well, I happen to agree with that, but not for the reasons that he states. But if the Fed goes into that mode right now where it says we're not going to respond to Trump's tariff threats and into the unknown abyss of what this is going to do, that plays into Trump's hand because Dudley doesn't make one mention of it. Because now, look, if that's the case, if Trump reads it that way, I think we're going to watch a real currency war take place, because that's in the purview of the White House. The Treasury Department has the control over the currency. And don't tell me how much they have in their stockpile of how much they can intervene. I've lived through the Plaza Accord. I've lived through the Louvre Accord. I've lived through Bob Rubin's pivot in June of 1998, when the United States talked about a strong dollar policy only to intervene to weaken the yen at the behest of the Chinese anyway, when Bill Clinton was going to China. We have all these things, and we could really get into some very ugly things because if Trump feels that the only thing he has left is the currency, I will tell you, watch out, because we're going to go into a volatile period across all asset classes, well beyond of everything that we've seen.
What do you see of the potential of that scenario unfolding, Guy?
I think that would be a disaster. And, markets are already kind of being hit with a level of randomness. I use that word other than uncertainty. Markets don't like uncertainty. But, we've priced in and out this kind of China thing so many times because the White House has been unpredictable. But I think we need to price out a lot of things. And one of the things we need to price out is the fact that the Federal Reserve can, they keep saying we're the only game in town. I think really what they need to start saying is we do not have the tools to be able to fix this or that. And I think the level of arrogance and hubris at the Fed in saying that has really reached an extreme. And I think they'd be better off kind of paring back. And when they do that, what it means is that this sort of underlying put that the market has come to realize that every time the market goes down, the White House will make it go back up or the Fed will make it go back up, I think is just not true. I think that central banks... I think that they've become marginally less effective. I think they're already too hyperactive in what they've done. I think they don't want to be the market like the Bank of Japan has become. They haven't completely broken it yet, but they're on the verge of breaking and wrecking everything. And I don't think they really want to do that. At some point, free markets and price discovery need to come back. And it's going to be a very difficult road to get there. There needs to be some Schumpeter type of, creative destruction. And they've shown no ability whatsoever to allow that to happen. And the more debt levels rise, the more difficult it becomes to normalize interest rates, because then defaults will go up and it won't be like a Ponzi scheme where you can just refi just to pay off your existing debt. The amount of debt servicing costs will go right into, if interest rates go up by 1%, I think that costs the United States government $160 billion in added interest expense. But the same thing happens to a corporation. It hits their bottom line pretty quickly. So that the effect is that the capital structure starts to price in more appropriate risk. It'll be less flat. Credit spreads will rise. Junk bonds, all those triple B corporates, which is 54% of the whole corporate market, will fall in the junk territory. So a lot of junk bonds will have to trade, from being way above their economic value to probably less than their true economic value. I think markets will have a liquidity problem. And so we're talking about a truly significant correction that could hit both stocks and bonds, and portfolios are certainly not set up for such a scenario.
Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, yes, those risk parity trades, which are the dominant trades on those huge hedge funds books, will blow up. That's their worst fear. And then you combine that with how much short volatility they've been in order to pick up a few extra percentage points in return. But there's so much there. I mean, guy is like just hit it out of the ballpark, as we would say, because all these points are dead right on.
You know, and this low interest rate means that, you know, we've come from this very long period of low volatility, because that's what QE and low interest rates have really done. It's taken the risk out of the market. So vols have come way down. So as Ira's reached completely right, there's a lot of short option strategies out there. But there's also a lot of leverage, a ton of leverage. You know, if your bond is only yielding 2%, what you do is you lever it three times so you can earn, you know, closer to 6%. So vols will go higher, and the leverage needs to come back. Now, it may not be on the books of the primary dealers and the banks. It's a lot safer there than it was in 2007. But that type of regulation there has chased it into the shadow markets, and there's certainly plenty of leverage that needs to be unwound. And so the scenario is not good.
No, and I'll tell you what, a classic example of what has really taken place, and again, the central banks want to pretend that they don't bear responsibility for the election of people like Donald Trump. You know, there's many reasons. You see it in Europe, especially, and the media just doesn't want to talk about it. But it's now coming to the head anyway. In Germany, the banks and others are pushing back, going because they can't charge customers negative interest rates. There's an article or two this week, and actually over the weekend, Jens Weidmann came out and said he was opposed to fiscal stimulus after the previous week we had heard about all these people in Germany being in favor of fiscal stimulus. But because Mario Draghi, and I'm going to use what Guy had said, which is the only game in town, because that's what he has told everybody, to cover himself for this ridiculous policy of perpetual QE. Yes, they ended it, but they're coming back to it, and negative interest rates on top of it. But what this has led to is that they have absolutely taken on the role of fiscal authority, because, you know, everybody talks about Germany stepping up to a full program of fiscal stimulus, you know, infrastructure. But I would argue for the German citizenry, and there is such a thing because they vote domestically. They don't vote. Forget the European Parliament. It's a paper tiger, except in its ability to set regulations and make your life miserable. But as far as real governing, it's a paper tiger. But the fact that the Bundesbank and the German government has taken on the complete responsibility for the credit of the European Union, which is, of course, why interest rates are as low as they are, because if it wasn't backstopped by the Germans, European interest rates would be much higher. But if there is a default, then if the Germans are on the hook for a massive amount of money, which they are, whether it's Target 2 funding or any other way you want to measure it,
it's about $1 trillion, I think, Target 2, isn't it, Ira?
Right, it is. And isn't that a fiscal stimulus? If you're pushing interest rates across the entire European Union, I mean, look at Italian rates on the 10-year, we're down to 114 today. You have supplanted German money as a fiscal stimulant to every other country, and now they're on the hook for it. So if I'm in Germany, I'm going, wait a minute, I don't need a fiscal stimulus plan. I'm already the fiscal stimulus for the entire project. So, and which is creating political fallout that the Draghi never talks about, because, you know, that would mean that he'd have to attain responsibility.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, you're right. The European Union looks more like a European disunion at times. But earlier I mentioned the Fed's strategy drift, and they've done sort of the same thing, right? They're acting more like a finance ministry. And if you go back to the original purpose, and by the way, there's a great of the Fed, and there's a great book. Roger Lowenstein wrote a book called America's Bank, which goes into great, it's a fabulous book. It just went into such great detail about the argument as to whether to have a central bank or not. And the arguments against are really being lived. They've stripped it away from their original purpose. And their original purpose was to act as a backstop for banks to prevent bank runs, like you saw in 1907, et cetera. And how do you do that? Well, if the bank really wasn't going to liquidate their own balance sheet and was going to go to the Federal Reserve would, you know, give them some penalty rate of interest and give them a loan. And then that loan was based on high quality collateral. And that's it. Right. That was the role of the central bank. So the FOMC has totally lost their way, should not be sitting there with a bunch of PhDs trying to micromanage like a financing ministry. They should really be filled with, let's go back to its original purpose and then come up with some good bank examiners who can, you know, look at the quality collateral that's coming in. And that's it.
Right. Hence the discount window. But it's interesting that you bring that up, because I was such an ardent opponent of the repeal of Glass-Steagall. I mean, I had a letter published in the FT in 2002, right after it passed, and I actually had a discussion with people who were instrumental in its passage. I go, it's a gigantic mistake, and as you touch, you know, because it forced me to read Carter Glass's autobiography, which was quite interesting, because of course he was so instrumental in the 1913 Federal Reserve Act. He was one of the mainstays. He was a very smart Virginia banker and had a lot of wisdom in what they were proposing. But when I say to people, I say, you understand, if you wanted to repeal Glass-Steagall, which to me created the 2007-2008 problem anyway, then you needed to repeal FDIC insurance. Because if you opted out of what Glass-Steagall prevented, then you can't have FDIC insurance, because most people don't realize that FDIC insurance was passed on the same day that Glass-Steagall was approved. So they were one and the same, because without that, you were, as I said in the letter to the FT, you were socializing the risk while you were privatizing the rewards. It was a mistake of gigantic proportion. And I'm not in favor of what they just did in rolling back some of the Volcker restrictions. They're terrible, terrible decision. Terrible. And, you know, again, some regulations are good. And if you have regulation, maybe you have good regulation, because bad regulation only harms those who need it the least.
I agree with you. You know, earlier, one of you mentioned about the social and political ramifications of the Fed and how it's wide reaching. And maybe I'm reaching a little bit, but you talk about socialized costs and privatized profits. And that was, you know, part of the uproar over bailing out the banks to the 2008 crisis, right? When you do it that way, they get to keep their profits, but the taxpayers on the hook for losses. People were outraged. But the whole Fed policy kind of rewards rich people, right? You also touched on inequality earlier in this conversation. And, you know, they're looking for inflation. Yeah, well, there's hyperinflation. It just happens to be in asset prices. Who owns asset prices? Rich people own asset prices, a vast majority of them. that's fine. If the whole pie is growing bigger, great. Then everybody is probably getting a little bit wealthier and prosperous. Now, the wealth inequality may widen because the rich get richer at a faster pace. And that's fine as long as you're dragging the people up and they're being rewarded for being productive in society and everything. But the Fed would never admit that they're creating this type of inequality. And so there is a good argument that should be had on the difference between what Fed policy is doing for Wall Street versus Main Street. And certainly think about the, you know, and this is where some people say, and I've taken it a little too far, and that's fine. I understand it. But think about what happens in globalization when a lot of jobs were outsourced overseas. Okay. Well, you gutted the industrial belt of America as we moved to a services society from a manufacturing society. But the problem with it is we never did anything to retrain those people in our factories. And so there's a hollowing out of the Rust Belt in Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And these people, when they had nowhere to go and nothing to do, you know, there are some of them that turn to, you know, opioid addiction and other things. But what happened is when every day you see the stock market and the bond market going up and the rich get richer, when you're in that middle part of the country, you feel as if your politicians are failing you. And, well, why is everyone getting rich? And I'm sitting here without training or a job. And part of that, and, you know, this may be a little bit of a reach, I do blame the Federal Reserve for the fact of this kind of wealth inequality, because they shouldn't be saying we're the only game in town, you know, and so, but they have, you know, and it's kind of silly to think that with the only tool of manipulating the price of money, interest rates, that it can lead to full employment. I wrote an article called The H Curve. And H stands for hubris. And basically what it says is that Fed policy to a certain level becomes counterproductive. In other words, when they cut interest rates below a certain level, what happens is it forces savers to save more. And all of the things they're trying to do can become counterproductive. And I really believe that is the case. Part of it is this kind of wealth inequality, the savers, the moral hazard issues that we've talked about.
Well, yeah, you know, classically, as you talk, is the paradox of thrift, which Keynes warned about. And I think back to when Bernanke and Yellen would come under questioning about that very point that you're making, Guy. The response was, I thought, that, like they were speaking to kindergartners, and they basically said to the savers, stop crying. Your home is going up in value. Your stock portfolio, and this, I'm quoting, I'm not making this up. This is what they said. Your portfolio is going up in value. Your grandchildren have jobs. Your children have jobs. What else do you want? And I thought it was, wow. I said, you got to do better than this. And yet they both went down that path as to justify the policies that they embarked upon, and I think it did terrible harm. And I will say this: as bad as the American worker, and I'm not talking again public sector, I'm talking private sector, was put upon by globalization. I ask people this question. I said, bond prices are going up. Who's buying bonds? I said, I'm telling you right now, it's the pension funds who are the biggest buyers of bonds. So when this all starts to unravel, and unravel it will, whether it's through debt repudiation, through the printing press, or just interest rates going higher and bond prices getting smashed, which will be its own worst outcome, it's the pension funds that are going to pay a price. So the workers are going to get, you know, those with pensions that are not all classified as workers per se, but those with pensions are going to get crushed on that way down. And in Europe, it's going to be even worse. So when everybody applauds everything that's done, I go, you know, it's, again, it's not so fast, because you have to think through this. And I challenge everybody when I talk to them, I go to trading rooms and have discourse with people. Tell me what you think the exit strategy is. And I challenged Bernanke in 2009. What's your exit strategy? Tell me how this ends. How do you get out of this? And he, you know, his attitude was, well, after QE1, which was fine and necessary, we'll just let them all roll off. I said, okay, until he embarked on QE2, QE3, which was QE to infinity, then it became too big.
Yeah.
You know, had he stopped at one, we'd be in a different place. But guy, that hubris, that's exactly right. So,
and you know what? I think people are not talking enough about the pension situation and what it does. So, you know, the average pension is 73% funded, you know, at this point, with asset prices being where they are. You're right. What is that going to look like when interest rates, you know, if and when interest rates rise? And the other thing is they're doing it all under the incentive to try to create inflation. But again, I go back to, why is inflation such a good thing? Well, you know, William McChesney Martin, the longest serving Fed governor chairman ever, said you can never regain the purchasing power of the dollar once lost. So mm-hmm. if you cut your purchasing power in half in 36 years by having 2% inflation, why is that such a good thing? And in terms of wealth inequality, what is a poor person's biggest asset? Well, it's not the stocks and the bonds that they're putting into a bubble. The poor person's biggest asset is cash. So their yeah. purchasing power, they feel that purchasing power is a percentage of their disposable income at a much more magnified level.
And what do they want to do? They want to wipe out cash with electronic money. So only for the sole purpose of people who argue with me, like, and I'm not a conspiratorial person. This is just, if you listen to them, they're telling it to you so that they can go to negative interest rates, because negative interest rates don't work as long as we have cash.
No, well, I don't know if they'll ever work. And then, I don't know if you can go to negative nominal rates in the United States that would destroy the money market industry. But what's interesting is this Carney, you make me think of the Carney comment the other day, which is so fascinating, because the U.S. is 20%, our GDP is 20% of global GDP, yet 50% of global trade is invoiced in U.S. dollars. So we play this sort of outsized role. And I guess maybe we should. The U.S. is more stable. It's the biggest economy. It's the world's reserve currency. But one of the things that he talked about was having some type of a consortium among commercial banks and central banks to have what I think he called a synthetic hegemonic currency, you know, whether it's SDR or gold or whatever, so that international trade can be priced in something other than the dollar. And we talked about what would happen if Trump would devalue the dollar. Well, I'll throw it out there. What would happen if all of a sudden, you know, you're not going to replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency anytime soon or immediately, but you start putting together another type of settlement and clearing mechanism for global trade that is not based strictly in U.S. dollars, all of a sudden the influence starts to ratchet lower a little bit, so that then the demand of dollars will fall. What will that do to, you know, bubble everywhere U.S. dollar-backed assets? I just raised that as a point. I find it fascinating.
No, that's a great point. And yes, he did raise that. Yes, it's a serious issue that exists out there. But hey, we may as well have the Libra, because that's where he was going. But you know, Mark Carney should have stayed in Canada. He did a nice job when he ran the Bank of Canada. After that, I think he punched away way too far above his weight. But that's just my opinion. And now he's looking for a new spot in the realm of the global banking hierarchy. So effectively, he was bypassed for the IMF's directorship. He's searching for something else, and that's what I thought that piece was about. I mean, there was really nothing new in it, but the fact that he gave it voice. Okay, I longed for Mervyn King, so that's all I can say about that.
Great. And just given, as the last question, given all these risks and trends, what are the implications for investments in the financial markets? Guy?
Yeah. Let me just say about the Fed, I think it's what they're doing, and I blame the Fed even more than other central banks because they are the holder of the world's reserve currency. So when they went to zero, everyone else had to go to zero to stop their currency from appreciating so much. So the Fed started it. The Fed has to stop it. And I think what they've done already is the greatest tragedy of our time. And it, and this tragedy is hiding in plain sight. And they've made it worse by creating the moral hazard we discussed, by offering up the market put that we've discussed, that has fueled a psychology of bullishness that is making people too complacent. So it's like a Minsky moment. And it can be disrupted very, very quickly by some of the things I spoke about, whether it's this anti-globalization push through currency wars, whether it's this new, you know, a new standard that takes place for pricing things in some, you know, new synthetic currency. But what should investors do is I think they're foolish to keep saying, oh, just go into the index or the benchmarks because markets always go up. They're trying to beat their peers and their benchmarks. It just shows a blatant disregard for valuations, for sizing appropriately. There's no fiduciary standards in that. I think portfolio can, you know, modern portfolio theory no longer works as because in a digital world, it's not normally distributed. Think about it this way. We're in a winner-take-all environment. Think about the FANGs, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google. That's responsible for about half of the returns over the last 1, 3, 5 years. And so why would you want to market average when we're in a winner-take-all type of environment? And I think that the skew in terms of upside potential versus downside risk is really being miscalculated by many, many portfolio managers, and certainly by IRAs who just are, you know, want to tell their clients, you know, never market time, stay in the market. It's the only way to make money. But I would say, well, at this point, with the low ammunition that we have, both in terms of fiscal and monetary policy, you know, a serious correction means, you know, we could have a 30-40% correction, and it's going to take you decades to get back to your high water mark. So then the question becomes, so what do you do? And I think you have to find non-correlated sources of idiosyncratic risk, meaning non-correlated to just stocks and bonds that you can only make money when they go up in price. Well, both of them are in kind of bubble-ish type of pricing, and that both of them have become correlated so that they do not have that 60-40 type portfolio. I wrote a paper about that recently. They do not have the characteristics that act as a good balanced portfolio. So there are plenty of good alternative strategies where 20 years ago, some of these alternatives were not investable alternatives. And today they actually are. But rather than long only equity, you could go into equity neutral funds or long short equity funds. There's activist funds, special situations, direct lending, peer-to-peer lending, and then real alternatives, like find a way to own some type of real assets, whether it's like timber or some real estate that gives you some stream of income, things like that. You're going to need to be much, much more creative. And that's what I think investors need to be cognizant of, that these risks are really, really significantly high, and they should focus on a better portfolio construction.
And Ira, your final thoughts?
Well, to put together, you know, because I'm a trader, I trade a lot of futures contracts, because that's where my leverage is. And even though I think all these long-term things, I trade in between all my thought processes because That's just what I've done for as long as I've done. But it doesn't mean that I can't see exactly what Guy's talking about. And he's right. And when he says timber and things of real asset value, you know, I've been a big proponent of gold. And as you know, from the pejorative people, I'll get, oh, you're a gold bug. And I go, no, I'm nothing of the sort. But can I call you a fiat currency bug? Because if you're going to be pejorative to me, I can fire back. Because if you're not, if you don't believe in hard assets, such as gold, silver, platinum, timber, listen, some equities are hard assets, because if they're businesses, and even hard times are coming, but they manufacture things and there's real capital behind it, meaning, you know, the manufacturing capital, those are worth owning, because economies just don't go upside down like that. So you have to seek out that which you believe will sustain itself and will generate enough of a return to get you through some of the worst of the times. And then again, those are real assets that will come with it, and avoid debt. I avoid debt like the plague. You know, I know that there's good debt, but companies that take on debt to do share buybacks, to issue dividends, to basically they do share buybacks because they're busy buying in stock from the options so that it's not dilutive. And all they're doing is passing it off. I don't know why people are so enamored with that. So I avoid companies with debt. So I look for things that have, you know, great potential and where there's value. You know, I believe that Mexico, even with AMLO and their politics a little bit strained, will come out at some point looking very, very good, because they have a growing population and a severely undervalued currency. If you want to talk about currency wars, the Mexican peso sits in a very great position once the trade war starts to calm down, because I think Mexico. So I look at things. Canada is loaded with good companies with real assets. So yeah, you have to be global. You have to think global. Until the only thing that global people have to fear is any kind of sense of capital controls. We haven't had those in a long time. I mean, they were experimented with by Malaysia under Mahathir Mohamad in the late 1990s during the Asian contagion crisis. But we have not really seen capital controls. So as long as capital control freely, you can find situations. But until I see some type of exit strategy from the central banks, I believe in gold against the currencies. That doesn't mean it won't have severe corrections. It will. And that's why I stay nimble and I trade and I look for levels of I look for low risk entries of where I can put on trades at low risk and I can get, you know, nice upside. And then when they get overextended or parabolic rises, I sell them. And if I was long bonds, which I'm not, I'm long 2 years and less, but I would be selling bonds, because you want to talk about parabolic patterns of price increases, bonds are certainly in that. So I would be getting rid of my bonds. Yeah, they can go up higher, but do I want to be part of them? Not for a second. So that's what I'd be looking to do. I want to get away from anything that smells of debt, because it's not going to be a very good outcome.
Well, great insight, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Guy?
I post a lot of what I've been writing lately on LinkedIn. I would encourage them to reach out to me either directly or follow some of my work there. I'm thinking about posting it in other areas, but that's to be announced. Thank you for asking that question.
Great. And Ira?
I am where I am, still writing at, Notes from Underground. And I'm doing, you know, I do these podcasts, which I think, you know, this is great. I'm glad I had to do this with Guy. I think there's a lot of stuff to be learned here. You may not find the trade that you want today, but if it keeps you from out of some trouble and doing some bad things, then it's even worth more. And just to be aware of the pratfalls. But I'm at Notes from Underground, where most of my thought process winds up in a blog. And again, the strength of the blog is only because of the discourse that takes place through the readership. So those are all good things.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll end it there. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.